Hi, I'm Dr. Stan Steindl, and welcome back to Compassion in a T-shirt, where we dive into the science and practice of compassion. Before we begin, I want to mention that I'm raising funds for Movember, an amazing charity supporting men's mental health and prostate cancer research. If you'd like to contribute, the link is in the description below. Every donation counts, and I truly appreciate it. Today, I'm thrilled to introduce our guest, Dr. Daniel Ellenberg. Daniel is a leadership coach, psychotherapist, and founder of Strength with Heart, a men's group focused on emotional intelligence and self-compassion. With over 25 years of experience, he's dedicated his career to helping men transcend traditional masculine roles and create deeper and more meaningful relationships. Daniel is also a co-founder of Relationships That Work and a principal at the Rewire Leadership Institute. And he's the co-author of Lovers for Life and has presented at major conferences on leadership, self-compassion, and emotional health. In today's conversation, Daniel shares his insights into the intersection of men, compassion, and well-being. We'll discuss the barriers men face in expressing vulnerability, the role of self-compassion, and how compassion can transform relationships. It's all right on topic for Movember. And so I bring you Dr. Daniel Ellenberg. Well, Dr. Daniel Ellenberg, welcome to Compassion in a T-shirt.
I'm very happy to be here with you, Stan.
Great. I'm looking forward today to talk a bit about men and compassion, actually, and to sort of do a bit of a deeper dive into that topic. What inspired you to sort of focus on this kind of, well, sort of exploring and promoting compassion and self-compassion and just sort of emotional well-being or psychological well-being sort of generally in men?
That's a big question.
Yeah.
But of course, we're on a podcast, so you should ask big questions, right?
Yes.
As opposed to what I'm wearing. Well, I think that I've been interested in the theme of well-being since I was a teenager. And then I wound up getting in a men's group when I was 27. I was looking for a group, but not specifically a men's group. And somehow, as the fates would have it, that's what appeared. And I joined, and I enjoyed a lot of it. Some of it was not to my liking, and I decided to leave men's groups. So I started that when I was 30. And I just stopped doing that at 70. So I'd led men's groups for 40 years, and with a major focus on well-being. I mean, I think that there's really nothing more important than that, because if the individual is not well, the couple or the family is not well, you just keep doing the math there. So we have to start off with kind of a positive sense and experience of oneself. And unfortunately, that's not necessarily a given in this world, to put it mildly. And it's a much longer story. I had a very long journey. But when I was president of my APA division, on American Psychological Association division on men and masculinities, there was a reach out from APA governance. And the way APA is organized is like there's 56 different divisions, and they have anything to do with psychology you can imagine, from forensic psychology to gerontology to health to counseling to masculinities, femininity, et cetera, like that. So the APA governance was interested in working with divisions on their outer world focus. And I reached back, since I was at that time immediate past president, and I wound up starting a group of psychologists who were really interested in how do we make a difference in terms of men and well-being in the world. And I was initially looking at, health, both mental and physical, because there are elements of the way men identify and practice the male role, so to speak. And that's a whole other story. What exactly is the male role? What exactly is the traditional male role? That's, we could go on a long jaunt in that direction. But I could see from the research and from practice and just keeping my eyes open that guys who were basically trying to brave through things and push things away and never admit that they were anxious or scared or had difficulties, basically they were pretending that they would have to erect certain shields to protect against feeling threatened. And they weren't really able to attend to the actual difficulties that they had because they weren't supposed to have those difficulties because it didn't align with their male role identification. So essentially we've seen through the research that there are poor health outcomes with guys who are more rigidly identified with a certain aspect of traditional masculinity, which is like being overly stoic, never asking for help, not showing vulnerability, always having to prove masculinity. These various factors contribute to a whole nexus of problems, you know, that men face. And I tell you, Stan, one of the biggest difficulties these days is to talk about this without someone saying you're trying to shame men, or you're saying that masculinity is bad. And it's not what I'm saying, and it's not what a number of people who are my colleagues who are saying, but that's what gets how it gets internalized and gets PR'd out in the world. It's nuts. It really is nuts. It's like you can't give a critique of what's not working so that things can work better without it. You're saying that the person is bad. No, that's not what we're saying at all. So again, longer story, but I was focusing on this and even looking at certain masculinity beliefs in terms of climate beliefs. You know, like somehow that green energy, according to one of our politicians here, is feminine. Right? And this is one of the big problems, is that certain traits and behaviors are put into that. This is masculine and this is feminine, which to me is nuts. Like, why are human traits put into these gendered categories? That's a problem, but it is a reality nonetheless. And I was looking at how do we start to really help deconstruct that way of being this kind of a certain kind of mentality. And then I wound up talking with my friend Rick Hansen, you know, who has done a lot of work. If you look like you know who he is. And
oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
He's one of my best buddies, and he started the Global Compassion Coalition, which I had some involvement with. And anyway, in conversations with him, I started to go like, maybe what we should do is really focus through one particular aperture of compassion and men and boys, and really look at the territory of compassion and self-compassion and see how that is actually related to everything else. And so I wound up, I had this pretty large group of people I was working with already who thought they were going in one direction in a way, and I was going, well, guys, I think I want to steer the ship a little differently here. And they all bought on, you know, and I had a whole bunch of people, non-psychologists inclusive, who are involved with what we're doing right now. And so our mission is really to look at how do we inspire more compassion from boys and men toward others, more compassion toward boys and men, as well as more self-compassion. And I absolutely believe the world would be very different if there were more compassion and self-compassion in the world, because guess what? You know, people suffer. We all have problems. We all have difficulties. And even if everything were going swimmingly, there's going to be difficulties that come up. There'll be a disease. You'll lose someone who's important to you. I mean, as we say in Buddhism, impermanence is the name of the game. The only thing that doesn't change is the fact that things are always changing. You know, yeah. And to have compassion, and compassion is a necessary salve to help us kind of, you know, navigate the path of life. And without that, things are very problematic, and they become increasingly polarized, as they are apparently on this planet right now.
Mm-hmm. There's so much to it, isn't there? Really, it's when we think about men and mental and physical health and the sort of the relationships and the families or the people around them and the way that the things kind of flow back and forward and so on and men being able to sort of be compassionate towards others, receive compassion from others, be more compassionate towards themselves. It feels like that's in a sense the core or one of the core sort of motivations that if we can cultivate that, all sorts of ripple effects come from there. Just before we get into that further, one little thing stood out to me, and because you said right at the start that you've been interested in emotional well-being since you were a teenager. I just wanted to see what, can you just paint a little, just a little picture of you as a teenager who's already, I guess, interested in well-being, interested in kind of compassion, really, in some ways.
Well, I mean, I was suffering. I mean, it was not oblique in my mind. I mean, my father died when I was 10, so that was a tough pill to swallow, put it mildly, and that led off into all kinds of difficult issues. I was like a straight A student, a reasonably happy little kid before then. I had a downward tilt, from there. By the time I was a mid-teenager, I was a behavior problem, and I was super depressed and anxious and just generally unhappy. And I just started kind of like, this can't be all there is there. And I think part of it is a certain kind of temperament or wiring. I've always kind of been curious about people. I mean, I would look out at the way adults treated each other and what they said to each other, and I would be thinking, like, they're not telling the truth. I mean, man, what is going on? I couldn't quite grok the nature of life. I mean, that's kind of a rather large statement, but I just couldn't orient toward it, despite the fact that in many ways I fit in. I was fairly athletic. I was reasonably good looking. I didn't have some of the issues that some people have, but internally I was suffering like crazy, and I didn't even want to talk to about it. And I knew that there was something about being able to be in relationship around difficulties that in and of itself was healing. And it was like, how did I know that? I don't know. I mean, how can we actually figure this out? I think there were some moments where I got to say certain things and I felt better, to do that. And I thought, this makes sense, to me. So it didn't have a role model. I had no one to follow. In this regard, I was kind of on my own path with it, and I just kind of wended and wove my way, through the path. And pain became a guide, and it's like I was determined on some level to not live in constant pain. So that was a motivation, for start.
That was the word that popped to mind for me, the sort of motivation that there's something about being able to engage with suffering that actually can be something of a wellspring for motivation towards compassion, towards helping others, helping ourselves. It's in the avoidance in a way, or the sort of shutting down to suffering that kind of, sort of becomes this massive block then, because we're putting all of our efforts into sort of not thinking about all of that. And so the suffering just continues.
Absolutely, 100%. I don't know if you remember like the old Star Trek, or if you're is going to, but I like to use the literal metaphor, if you can use a term like literal metaphor, which may sound a little oxymoronic, as it were. But when the USS Starship was under attack by the Klingons, for example, they had a device called the cloaking device. And the cloaking device would make the ship invisible on every level to an enemy. And so, boom, it would like disappear, and the Klingon ship would be, and go, where'd they go? You don't know where they are, which is great. I mean, it's a great defense. Just like that. Can you imagine if somebody's upset with you and you just disappear and they can't see you? Anyway, that's another story. But I'm turning on my cloaking device. But the thing about the cloaking device, the downside was that it made every other operation in the ship inoperable. The only thing it could do was it could be invisible to an invading ship, but it couldn't do anything else. That's how I look at defenses in a certain way. And what you were saying reminded me of that, which is that if we don't deal with reality, essentially, that, okay, this hurts, this is painful. If we're denying that, avoiding that, pushing it away, and not allowing it to be in consciousness in any way, we can't deal with it at all. We just can't deal with it. And so when you were saying, Stan, about to be attuned to your own suffering as in some ways the wellspring, you didn't use the word creativity, but that's how I was hearing it, creativity in relationship, then you're able to be essentially in reality, like you're congruent, like your insides and your outsides match. The problem is when the inside and outside don't match, when they're dystonic in some way and they're avoidant and you're constantly living some distance away from yourself. And so we have to pay attention to reality. I mean, I think one of the interesting things is, I don't know how much your audience would be familiar with emotional hijacking. Joseph LeDoux, who's a neuroscientist, who was going to popularize the amygdala, which is essentially that how we get triggered about things. Somebody says something, you oh, get all activated, your blood pressure goes up, your sympathetic nervous system, goes on overdrive. That's basically the system, the organism, the human being is feeling threat at that time. And he originally called that fear conditioning, but then he came out years later and he said that was his major professional regret was that he called it fear conditioning rather than threat conditioning. And I hope this isn't too academic right now, but I think it's an important point, which is essentially what he went on to say was that we have two different systems in the brain, obviously more, but the two he's talking about. One is the threat system, which is basically how a human animal or humanimal, as I like to talk about us, is organizing around threats. Because you don't pay attention to an actual real threat, guess what happens? I mean, you can get taken out of existence like that. So we have to be particularly attuned to threats, which is why we have negativity bias, essentially, because if we're not paying attention to those, it's doomsday, right? And so, but threats don't have to be conscious at all. The organism is reacting to threats, but could literally have no awareness that feels threatened. Fear only comes when there's consciousness or awareness about feeling threatened. Oh, I'm scared now. I am aware that there's a threat. Now, I've thought about this actually quite a lot. Some might think this is kind of academic in a certain way, but to me, it's super fascinating because I thought about it immediately in terms of men's psychology. And I went, oh, God, that explains so much because a lot of guys feel threatened quite often. But if you ask them, hey, man, you're afraid? I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid at all. I'm defensive as hell, but I'm not afraid. No, they're not saying I'm defensive. But the thing is, if an organism feels threatened and doesn't do anything, and this is where the compassion comes in, and doesn't do anything to help alleviate that sense of threat, it will automatically go into a defensive reaction. Fight, flight, freeze, appease, some variation of those. And it will never come back to a kind of safety, or kind of a homeostasis. So it's always going to be in constant threat, which is when you're on sympathetic overdrive and your system can't relax and can't feel safe in some way, it makes you more prone to different diseases, diseases of the mind, diseases of the body. And so in order to actually become healthier and have greater well-being, you have to pay more attention, i.e. be more aware of when you feel threatened and find ways to help alleviate that threat and to come back to greater safety.
The thing I
And
love about oh, sorry.
no, go on.
Well, the thing I love about your literal metaphor is that it's a sort of a both and, isn't it? It's both a very like the cloaking device was super helpful and very protective and was kind of helped to protect the ship, in those dire moments of Klingon attack or whatever. And it meant that all of the other functions of the ship were shut down. And so they would just, I think, have to kind of hover and wait until the threat had passed. And it's like that, I suspect, for men, and the way that some of these more traditional kind of ways of being operate as well. On the one hand, they probably are protective and they've been learned across life and through sort of social conditioning of one sort or another to be an effective way to deal with threat. And at the very same time, shuts down other functions. And so there are other things that are now out of reach when they're in those more defensive or frustrated or those kind of modes. I noticed you used the term sort of traditional male roles or something like that, rather than the phrase toxic masculinity or something. And you mentioned how sometimes people feel like this discussion is a bit shaming or that sort of thing. Tell us a bit about some of that, the traditional roles, this notion of toxic masculinity that gets spoken about, how men sort of are shaped to, avoid emotion and avoid the compassion stuff.
Well, I and many people in my line of work avoid that term like the plague, toxic masculinity, because in and of itself it's shaming, and I don't think it's accurate. I don't think men are toxic, and I'm not. I know there's actually a lot of acrimony in general toward particularly white men, white heterosexual men these days. I mean, it's like it's used to be the best thing. Now it's quite different, from this kind of pendulum type thing. And that's the way we're always looking for who to blame. The secret to success is finding people to blame for your problems in a certain way, which is obviously I'm being a bit ironic, in saying that. So I think toxic masculinity is a very bad term, and it misses the point. I think about like Paul Gilbert. I don't know if you know, Paul Gilbert is, the founder of compassion-focused therapy, and I've had many conversations with him, and I appreciate his term for it, which I have adopted since then, which is toxic competitiveness, not toxic masculinity. And so, competition, at root doesn't have to be toxic at all. I mean, you can literally the meaning of it comes from the Latin competere, which is to strive together. So you use each other to become better, and challenge yourself to, to go faster and to bring more of your resources to bear. But the toxic masculinity starts getting conflated in a way where guys hear that and they go like, "You're shaming men," and I kind of agree with that. In a certain way, so I'm not at all interested in shame, period, with the exception of maybe some healthy shame that some people could stand to use more, like some politicians, for example. But that's not, we're probably not going to go there today. Probably shouldn't, But I think that the toxic masculinity is just not the best way of getting people to change, essentially, because when you start throwing insults at people, it doesn't make them want to open up. It's much more like, I think about the Aesop's fable on the sun and the wind, the wind trying to get some traveler's coat off, and the traveler is grabbing his coat and getting tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter, i.e. he's feeling threatened by that and he's defending himself against it, versus when the sun comes in and beams light and love or compassion on, he opens up his coat. And I think we don't enough of that. And we don't do enough of that with boys, for sure. And we try to toughen boys up. And this is part of the traditional masculinity, like teaching boys that they need to be tough and they need to, on some level, circumvent their natural vulnerability and really their desire and ability to connect emotionally with others. And when you start shaming emotions and wanting to love your friends and hug hug and be connected. And somehow that's not okay because you have to, you know, toughen up and be a real guy or something. That's where the problem begins. You know, and that cultural, it's more than a cultural thing. It's almost like a planetary thing that somehow, as I think, archaic roots in kind of hunter-gatherer, you know, societies where you had to, man had to protect, and the hunters out there and protecting the tribe, you know, kind of makes sense then. You know, so all of roles make sense at a certain point in history, but they don't seem to change because our rites and rituals are much slower to change than the causes, conditions, and context of life on this planet.
Right. You know,
whereas we're going abiding by things from the Old Testament or something, go, really, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, and like, really, is that, what are we doing? So we have to keep revising our operating systems right now. Mm-hmm. And I think that the compassion and self-compassion approach to men, masculinity is really necessary. I fear for the future of the world without that. I fear for the future of the world even with it, but without it, forget it.
Right. Yes, I am a big fan of Paul Gilbert too, who you mentioned. And one of the things I have found sometimes in some of the discussions in CFT is that competitiveness can come along sometimes with a bad name, almost that competitive. We want to be in the soothing affiliative system, and to be too much in the drive system or too competitive is kind of a problem too. Whereas I really appreciated what you said there, striving together, you know, in a sense, and is what where the word comes from. And I'm a massive Beatles fan, and so it just reminds me of Lennon and McCartney, you know, that they were sort of in competition in a way, you know, like they were kind of trying to, you know, sort of bring each other their next song, and kind of then the other guy's like, oh gosh, that's a good song, I got to do better, sort of thing or whatever. And I definitely appreciate that the sense that you know, competition can absolutely be healthy and productive and positive. And
I mean, the problem is that I find that there's such either or thinking, you know, in general in the world. We have to batify, it's not really a word, but maybe should be, you know, certain things, and this is good, this is bad, this is right, this is wrong, this is the way it is. And it's just never that simple. And I think about it, was it H.L. Mencken? I love it. It's my new favorite quote. He said, for every complex problem, there's a solution that's simple, neat, and wrong.
Okay, right.
You know, and it's like these single cause explanations about the way, why guys are the way, why the world is the way it is. It's like, are you kidding? It's way more complex, and I don't think we think enough about complexity, you know, in different parts, and even like with competition. You know, it's a complex territory. There's no question about it. It can be done super well. You know, you can have people who are compete, you know, for Wimbledon or the Australian Open, which I went to last year.
Oh, okay.
You know, you know, but they can be good buds. And it's important to know your paradigm, you know, because, you know, competition can be wonderful in a certain paradigm. Like, you look at vulnerability, okay? That's a very interesting territory. Vulnerability, like, it literally means openness to attack. And you go like, why would I want to be vulnerable if it makes me open to attack? Well, yeah, in a very competitive paradigm, you don't want to be vulnerable. You want to work on your vulnerabilities, and you want to exploit the vulnerabilities of your opponent so that you can win, because it's a win-lose paradigm. But if you're in a marriage, or friendship, you know, or with a colleague who you're trying to collaborate with, if you're in a paradigm like that and you don't know what to do, you're not sure, or you feel awkward, or you feel insecure in some way, you're doubtful, or you screwed up and you don't know how to apologize, and you think this is a highly toxically competitive paradigm that I have to hide my vulnerabilities. You never have an opportunity to connect because it's through our vulnerabilities, meaning that we're just being open, you know, to what is. And when you're open to what is, well, guess what? Part of what is you don't know what you're doing. You know, you're confused, you're in doubt, you know, you screw up, you wish you hadn't said that. I mean, I've been there like, you know, how many times? Don't answer that, Stan. You don't know me that well.
No, exactly. It's sort of it's a flexibility of the mind, isn't it, to be able to shift about and move across paradigms, really, and to be able to have that sort of, I guess there's a range of competencies, really, to be able to move from threat or drive or soothing, you know, that we're sort of able to kind of move about, and compassion is something of an overarching motivation, really, that can helps to organize the systems and to help create that flexibility. I mean, the $64 million question then, I suppose, is how do we do that? You know, with men and boys and so on, how do we start to sort of reshape some of these kind of ways of being and perhaps now somewhat outdated ways of being or whatever, and bring compassion in, bring self-compassion in? What are your thoughts there?
Many.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a conversation, this meeting, like the compassion piece around this between me and numerous colleagues for quite some time. So it's definitely in my pattern to be reflecting on this. And one of the big questions has been, do we even use the word compassion? Right? Like, if you look around, like Movember, largest men's mental health organization in the world, which started in your country, you know, they don't use the word compassion, you know, in their materials. Equimundo, probably the second largest men's organization in the world, you know, they don't use the word compassion, they use the word care. I've spoken to people high up in both organizations and they get it. They're going like one of them, I'm not going to mention any, I said, well, how is compassion selling to guys? Because there is something around that guys generally hear compassion and they hear it in ways that are actually inaccurate to what it means. You know, they hear compassion as, oh, don't be compassionate toward me because that means you're pitying me, which means you think I'm less than. You know, it's a sign of weakness, or that if you're self-compassionate, you're not going to be motivated to get better. You know, so there turns out that it's been like the territory of self-compassion has been pretty well researched, and these are just fallacies about what it actually is. It's not like that. The motivation doesn't change. I mean, it changes, but it becomes healthier motivation because there is a natural desire, I believe, for human beings to want to grow. You know, the flower, you know, in the morning, and I'm calling us flowers, oh my God, we're flower children. You know, the flower in the morning is down and the sun comes up and it starts moving. It moves toward the sun. I really believe that we humans, we move toward the sun, but are the causes and conditions that kind of pound us down that get in the way of that natural movement toward growth and expansion. Because imagine that you're a little boy, if we're talking about boys and men, and you're like going, yay, wow, this is exciting, and like this is, they're, you know, the way they're running around, and then eventually they start learning that, no, don't do that, that's not cool. You know how uncool you look when you do that? Dude, come on, man, pull it in, Jesus Christ. Looks like a girl doing that. That's where the shaming, you know, starts coming in. The shaming is toxic. Masculinity, the boys and men are not. And I think it's important to distinguish between the cause and conditions that lead toward negative events and outcomes and behaviors and the people who wind up internalizing those, because essentially they're just learning how to survive in the context they're in. If people weren't doing that, if they weren't shamed for that, they wouldn't tighten up. Pretty much that simple.
Yeah. Who does the shaming, do you think? Is it men? Is it mothers and fathers? Is it just other Boys, I mean, or probably everyone.
Yes, that's what I was just going to say. Like every, and pretty much, I was pretty, whatever you were going to say, I was probably going to say yes. And not all of them, not to say that everyone's them. It's enough. It's these are cultural matrices that have lived for a very long time, and again, it's hard for them to die. But
So
we need, if I may say, this thing, which is, we need to educate the public about what real compassion is, because real compassion absolutely takes courage to do, because you have to actually come into face to face, body to body, experience to experience with someone else or someone else who are actually suffering, and you need to be able to maintain your own sense of self in the face of that suffering and to help alleviate that suffering. So it really takes courage to face that, just like it takes courage to face your own difficulties, which you were bringing up before, and not avoid or deny them or move away from them, but to actually go, this is what's true. That's true acceptance. This is what, like, not as we wish it were, not as we fear it was. This is the way it is. And now, what do I do with this? How do I deal with it? But if you won't face what is, you can't change it.
Yes, that's one of the misinterpretations, I guess, isn't it? Is for sometimes men and others as well, sort of don't they miss that idea of that courage is often the key. It takes so much courage to do the engaging with suffering piece of compassion and strength and courage and wisdom. They're often sort of powerful qualities and concepts that people sort of see compassion as something weak or soft or too much like pity, when we're really thinking about compassion as strong and courageous and wise and caring and helpful as well.
Isn't it ironic? I mean, it's the most. I mean, here you are focusing on compassion, and so this must be in your face every day, on some level. And I'm how do we get people to really get that compassion is
What
a
it
superpower,
is.
and it's not this. I mean, it's mind blowing.
Yes, it's funny because I've said this before, but on the YouTube or whatever, I get those comments even, people sort of having a go at me or whatever to say, oh, this compassion stuff is, kind of rubbish and, it's a shame. If one guy said, sort of shame on you or something like this at one stage, in the YouTube kind of commentary, it's really sort of very prevalent somehow or other that some of these, kind of, well, I guess what they are is it again, it's the threat system thing, isn't it? It feels threatening. The idea of compassion flowing across the three flows is threat system activating in one way or another. And so up come those defenses again. We're kind of circling back to that same, the cloaking of the USS Enterprise or whatever is kind of happening even in and around the notion of compassion in a
Oh,
way.
absolutely. I mean, it's recursive, in that regard. It keeps kind of turning back on itself everywhere you look. I mean, there's a theory in gender, particularly around men and masculinity, called precarious manhood. And it's, from my eyes, it's probably the most widely accepted theory there is around male development. And part of the reason why is because it's quite well researched. And so the basic thesis is that boys learn that they have to prove their masculinity, and that proving masculinity is difficult to do. And if it is done, it's easy to lose. I'm talking about football. And it must be demonstrated in public. And so you can imagine just the level of vulnerability there, because basically, I'm like, you're not really a man, period. You have to prove that you're a man. And part of proving that you're a man is that you're never going to back down. You're tough. You know, you're not vulnerable, you know, in any way, and you're willing to fight for it if anyone looks at you the wrong way. Which, when you turn it on its head, you go like, man, how insecure do you need to be that you're going to be ready to fight and keep proving your masculinity? Because who are you actually proving that to? To the world? Because to some degree, it's saying, like, I don't really care about myself. Like, I'm not going to attend to what I'm actually experiencing. I'm going to have to keep kind of interpersonalizing, I know it's not really a word, my own personal issues. By if I get you to think I'm cool and I'm strong, I'm a strong guy, then I am. You know, and so it's really kind of the worst of the self-esteem movement, you know, in a certain way, which is basically how you're seen in the eyes of others, which is not how Nathaniel Brandon, who was a psychologist who actually coined the term self-esteem, meant it at all. It was a complete turning on the head of what he was doing. That's another story.
Yeah, there's sort of there's a need to kind of prove, but also keep proving, I guess. You know, we're kind of white knuckling it, aren't we? You know, sort of boys and men, you know, just the whole time having to prove.
Which is really interesting when you think about the ironies of it, that you're proving that you're a strong individual and you don't give a shit about what other people think on the one hand.
Yes.
But you have to prove to them that you don't really care about what they think, because of course you have to do it in public. And of course, if anyone looks at you the wrong way, you can't back down, even if you think it's insane to fight, you know, or get involved in it, because you're not actually secure in your own skin.
Yes.
And so it teaches you quite the opposite of what, ironically, we're taught to be as men, as strong, independent characters, because you're the opposite. You're actually totally dependent on having to keep doing something that there's a high likelihood that on a very deep core level, you don't even believe in.
Yes, there's almost a correlation there. The person who is more demonstrative of strength and dominance is perhaps within themselves feeling less secure. You know, like you mentioned, and I relate to it too. You know, you said right at the start that even as a teenager, you were pretty smart and, you know, good looking and athletic and so on. I mean, I think in those terms as well, but in some ways that's it, you know, that's the very, very thing. Just to sort of do a little kind of turn though too, and that is that, you know, I often look at boys and adolescents and I just find them just adorable and awesome, and often they're in there with their mates and they are looking after each other, and they do it in different ways perhaps, but you know it's doesn't seem to me that they're sort of absent of compassion, you know, in the way that they operate, and it's often maybe it's a kind of a doing type of a thing, or it's a kind of a joking kind of a thing or whatever. But so, yeah, boys and men kind of actually also are compassionate.
Absolutely. I don't doubt that in the least. I mean, part of what I'm thinking about, Stan, when you say that, is I wonder about, like, cultural differences between Australia and the United States. Like, one of the things I've noticed, and I mentioned to you before we got on, that I was in Australia I'd spent like a month in different parts of Australia between January and March, going back and forth a bit. And one of the things I noticed there, my wife noticed this also, was that it just felt safer and friendlier in your neck of the woods. Like, it just, people were just kind of just genuinely just friendlier, nicer. It just felt different than in the United States, you know, where there's much more my experience. I don't think I'm alone there, but more of a sense of tightness and more boundaried, in a certain way. So I don't know how much what you're talking about does have a certain kind of cultural difference in the United States, because I don't doubt that that happens in the United States also, the way you're describing, ways at all. It just, I suspect that there's a little bit more of that in my neck of the woods, that kind of down than there may be in yours. And I don't know if that's true, but
No.
anecdotally, that was the experience I had.
I mean, there's kind of contextual sort of factors at play, isn't there? And those are sort of, there's a lot at stake, it seems, in America at the moment. And so everyone's a little bit on the edge of their seat, and threat systems are, mind you, we're coming into that sort of a season as well, sort of politically and so on. I mean, some of my dearest friends in the compassion world and the motivational interviewing world and so on are American people who are very lovely and compassionate and men. I suppose what I was sort of thinking was we want to also catch men being good or something.
Yes.
That's or for want of a better way of saying it, but it's there. It emerges from them. We had some pretty devastating floods here many years ago, and I was around helping one of my friends, whose house had gone under basically, and there was a sort of an older guy there. He was driving one of those little sort of one man diggers, moving mud and whatever. And I remember I said to him, what made you kind of feel such compassion, to come? And he was like, "What? Compassion? Nah, I just wanted to do something to help." And I'm like, "That's kind of what I mean." But like there's often community, men step up, often in those sort of moments.
You're raising a very important point. That's a funny story in a way. I just want to help. It's like, yeah, but that's what we're talking about in terms of the education. Like, they don't get that that's what he was doing. He said to him, "Hey, let me sit down here next to you and give you a lesson in compassion." I'm sure he would have been really open to that. I'm joking.
Yes, exactly.
But what you're talking about, interesting enough, is what we're part of my group and the Men and Boys Compassion Coalition were talking about yesterday, which is that we want to really be finding clips of guys just expressing compassion in ways that we don't call it compassion. Like, I think about watching the Olympics recently, and the U.S. gymnast team, there are like five of them, and one of their stars on the team apparently fell off the horse. And so, once every 4 years, and you have one shot at this thing. It's just talk about pressure, insane pressure, devastation. He let himself down. He let his teammates down because not only would his own individual scores go down, but the whole team scores would go down, and he felt terrible. And they showed sort of a picture of him sitting on the bench a few minutes later. And he looked forlorn, to put it mildly. And one of his teammates came up to him and sat down next to him and put his arm around him. And then you could just see this guy, he kind of like, from his threat system to his calm. So you could just feel that. And that's really exactly what compassion does. Is it activates the calming system or the soothing system, right? And without that, you're just going to constantly be in threat mode. Drive threat, drive threat, drive threat, drive threat, drive threat. And so that compassion from the other, it just helped him. And to me, it was super moving, watching these high-level athletes doing that. And guess what? That's not unusual. That is actually very common practice. In sports, certainly in the military, can be extremely compassionate, but they don't use the words like that. They don't call it that. But the actions can be incredibly uncompassionate. And I agree. I think one of the things that we're looking at is how do we make visible what's invisible in clear sight, strange way. And that's a very important part of it, because if you tell someone like, hey, you don't have a certain trait or capacity at all, but we want you to really develop this, but you don't have any of it. That's a big hill to climb there. But if you say like, you got some of this, and you could use more. I mean, there's a quote I love. It's Shunyo Roshi. What's he said? You're perfect, and you could use some improvement.
Yeah, well, it's very like the old CFT. It's not your fault, but it is your responsibility, I suppose. We're wanting to really move away from the shaming and blaming, and we want to sort of help with the motivation to sort of still take responsibility for those bits that perhaps are more unhelpful. I must admit, I've found myself lately moving towards the word helpfulness as a kind of an alternative to compassion, because even caring can sometimes come along with connotations, I think. But sort of helpfulness, what may I be helpful, rather than harmful, basically, to myself and others, and trying to. But I definitely love that idea of little exemplar, sort of moments where men are demonstrating compassion across the different flows. What are the ripple effects there, do you think? If men are able to, cultivate this sort of a thing and do it perhaps in their own way or whatever, and but what are the ripple effects then for the people around them and maybe even society?
Everything. I mean, first of all, how would that happen, and what would that look like if suddenly there was something ordained and boom, it just happened, and people were just suddenly showed up as more compassionate? Wow, what a different world it would be. They would be fighting for a traffic spot, or for a parking spot, or just trying to butt their way into line, or be pushy, and it wouldn't be so WIIFM, what's in it for me? But it'd be much more of a communal, collaborative, collective experience rather than just an individual one. I mean, we know that given certain circumstances, people will become more or less prone toward narcissism. And narcissism, often misunderstood, is not falling in love with oneself. Narcissus, from the original myth, fell in love with his image. And so I think that we don't have enough self-love. We have too much loving of one's self-image, or it's too much fighting around self-image. And so I think that the compassion actually takes you out of the image part and takes you more to relationship, because you have to be relational. When you think about like your friend you were talking about, that's a horrible story. Sounds like he lost his whole house. And obviously that's beyond miserable. And care about your friend, and you want to be helpful. So you volunteer your time. You're not asking for anything in return, because he's in your heart and you want to make a difference for him. That's beautiful. And that's a natural human behavior. And what if the world was such that that were more the rule than the exception? I mean, I don't know if it would be exactly heaven on earth, but it certainly wouldn't be hell on earth. And sometimes I wonder, what exactly this earth is.
Yeah, the threat system really narrows the focus of attention, doesn't it? And it turns us inward, and we sort of get lost in that much more self-oriented kind of, the self-image piece.
And sadly, there are a lot of people in power who use that threat system for power. Because we know that the best way to control people is to, freak them out.
Yeah,
And
make them afraid.
get people to feel threatened, and then to feel threatened. Why? Because of those people out there. I will save you from that. But those people out there, that's what you have to watch out for. And of course, that's exactly what you're saying is right. Threats doesn't close down. You're into a defense pattern. Unmitigated threats trigger defensive reactions naturally. And so you're in a defensive state. And when you're in a defensive state, you're guarding against. And when you're guarding against, you're not very fluid. Your boundaries are too tight. We want to have healthy boundaries, like a healthy cell wall, that has a certain kind of integrity itself, but is also permeable enough, to allow nutrients to flow from within and to flow in from without. And that's how I look at relationships. But if they're too tight like that, then you just have, danger and threat in the world. And, we're not going to have a good world where people just keep harping on that. And which is not to say there aren't threats and dangers. I mean, there are. But I think that we tend to over-exaggerate those.
It's amazing that I guess there's definitely been a sort of progress over the millennia, but I've been listening to the Rest Is History podcast lately, and the Roman invasion of Britain, back in 50 something AD or whatever. And there was all this PR at home about the Britons and how primitive they were, and they had these, you might relate to this, they had this facial hair that was so, kind of a sign of them, and apparently blue paint and whatever. And there was just this, the crowds were cheering whenever we were able to, kind of defeat the Britons, and then the more recent episodes have been on the French Revolution, and same again, it's all that kind of othering piece, and the Austrians or whatever are going to invade, they're about to invade, you're not safe, we need to, kind of go and, fight a war. And even now there's that, all sorts of examples of this same phenomenon for some reason, where well, I suppose it works, I guess, in a sense, and
Yeah,
that's what just
right. It
keeps sort of
works.
going. But just imagine a compassionate motivation that's kind of widespread. Firstly, we'd all be feeling much calmer and much less stress, but it would be opening ourselves up, and our focus, our attention could start to open up, and we could be just much more, just interested in the well-being of ourselves and others. It would be a very different world.
And we could have more fun.
That that's a big one that Paul says too, is that, compassion can be playful or fun or those sorts of things as well.
Well, I mean, you think about love, okay? Now, you can be loving without being compassionate, because compassion, to me, is, and Paul would probably disagree with me on this
I think so.
about everything. But I do tend to see compassion as an emotion. He doesn't see it so much as that, but as love and plus awareness of suffering of others and with a genuine desire to help. But you have to, it becomes murky. Like, words themselves are inexact. Words are the map and not the territory, in a certain way. So what exactly does love mean, and what does care mean, what is helpful mean? I mean, we can have different interpretations about what those mean. So it's probably useful to define one's terms, for starters. I.e., why would we need to define what compassion is? Because people have different associations about what that means or what does love mean. Someone says, "I love you," and the other person says, "No, you don't." And you go, "What do you mean I don't love you?" And they get in a fight about it, right? But I'm kind of like, "Well, what does love mean to you?" Because the way people feel loved is not necessarily the same as somebody who's delivering the love. That person may be feeling loving, but if it's not on that person's love map, who's the receiver, it just may not land.
Yeah, no, Paul does have a particular view, I think, but a kind of a benevolent loving, or a sort of a humanistic loving, or being sort of bringing that kind of love and kindness to it is seems, absolutely right. The not the romantic love or those sorts of bits and pieces, but
To me, it's like being a good citizen. I don't think we spend enough time defining what exactly that means. We use the word citizen's a common word, right? But I don't think it's commonly understood, or that we agree. But what are the tenets of being a good citizen,
That's
right?
an interesting way in, actually. In terms of this thing about, is compassion the right word? But being a good citizen, that perhaps has a different kind of resonance. Well, I do feel that I like to think at least that we're moving in a direction. I certainly take your point that sometimes I look around myself and it feels tough. But then on the other hand, there are many people doing very good work, not least yourself. And so I really appreciate the work that you're doing, especially around men and boys and compassion. And I'm very interested. I hope we get to speak again about, some of that out, sort of ourselves. But for now, yes, Dr. Daniel Ellenberg, I really do appreciate you coming and talking with me on compassion in a t-shirt.
Well, my pleasure, and I really acknowledge you, Stan, for the work you're doing, because I think it does take courage to do what you're doing, because you put yourself out there and then you get some nasty reactions there, and it's doing what you're doing is not for the faint of heart. And I suspect a lot of people don't realize that you do potentially put yourself in the crosshairs of some people who are not exactly compassionate and feel threatened by that. And so good for you. I was going to
Great.
say good on you, but it's a little too colloquial, huh?
Okay, no, that's good. No, thank you. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks, Dan.